as a people, we need to stand up and not allow this type of stuff to happen, because if they feel comfortable, they grow.
We
have to find ways to make them feel uncomfortable every place. They need to be met every single place that they show up, and they need to be confronted. And that's how you change it. It's scary, like, you know, for people that aren't used to that type of confrontation. But there's so much at stake. Learn some self-defense, you know, or rally, run around and rally up people around you so you have numbers that stand up to it.
Well,
silence is what allows this to grow.
We're just about out of time. I've got a few announcements to make, but I want to say thanks to Tom from the Pacific Northwest Anti-Fascist Workers Collective and Michael B. from the Carpenters Local for coming on the air with us. In labor news, James P. Hoffa was reelected narrowly as the president general of the Teamsters Union. Some members want a change after years of concessions and lost ground. Hoffa's been general president of the Teamsters since 1998. This reelection will keep him in power through 2021. That's 23 years of running one of the largest unions, representing 1.4 million workers. Voice actors of SAG-AFTRA, that's the Screen Actors Guild and American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, are still on strike. They want a secondary compensation for games that sell over 2 million copies. The amount they're seeking is equal to one union scale per 2 million sold. That's currently $3,300. Management claims that will put them at a competitive disadvantage in a market that they only have a 20% share of. The union responds that that claim is disingenuous because the games that sell more than 2 million copies, the union share is nearly 100%. Members also request transparency. They'd like to know what role they're taking before signing on, and they'd like increased safety involving stunt coordinators. Who knew that voice actors participate in stunts? Also, the Plumbers and Steam Fitters Apprenticeship is now accepting applications until December 2nd, 2016 at 3 p.m. If you're interested, get your application in as soon as possible. A first-term apprentice earns $17.13 per hour plus benefits, and that scales up to $42.83 per hour at journeyman scale at the conclusion of the five-year program. If you're interested, please visit www.ua290.org or call 503-691-1997. And that looks like we're out of time. Prison Pipeline's up next. Thanks, everyone, for listening to Labor Radio, and we'll see you next week.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Community Radio, and I am here tonight with Bo Johnson. Bo is the author of The End of Justice, and we're going to be talking about his book and about how and why America is systematically criminalized. So first of all, Bo, welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
Great. So, Bo, you wrote a book called The End of Justice. So let's start by talking about your book. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. The End of Justice is a book that I wrote while I was unjustly incarcerated in a federal prison. The subtitle is Why America is the Most Incarcerated Country in the World. And I think if to do the question justice, I would simply say that as I went through a federal trial and then experienced the aftermath as far as being taken into the federal prison system, I took a step back, a very large step back, and I asked myself, what is going on and why did this happen? And I came to the conclusion, which is the thesis of my book, that the ignorance, the apathy, and the fear of the American people gives rise to the institutional arrogance of governing authorities that leads to the high incarceration rate that we have in this country. So that's the thesis of the book. And what I decided to do is to interact with inmates in prison. And I met many who were guilty of the crimes for which they were charged. And surprisingly, I met a number who believed they were innocent. So I decided to dissect their cases. I took copious notes. I went back and I asked questions of these men again and again to test their veracity, their trustworthiness. And by and large, I found them to be congruent with their first representation. So that was noteworthy to me. So I took each case as a result and I broke it down. In fact, I broke the legal system, the entire justice system, down into 10 components. And I analyzed each case based upon the particulars and realized that each man who claimed they were innocent was found guilty because of one, two, or maybe three of those components out of the 10. So I realized I had something. I realized that average Americans, if they step away from the justice system, they gratuitously conclude that the system is overall just. I then realized, having gone through the experience of a trial and now incarceration, of the pitfalls and the fractures and the faults within the system that led to innocent men being incarcerated. So I call the diagram the four corners of justice, and that is the impetus of the book, is to take a diagram as a representation of a court case and to show the average layperson how a man or a woman is unjustly incarcerated in the end. That's the focus of the book.
Well, let's talk about that, because I know that there's a lot of things, there's a lot of tricks that DAs use to get people into prison. And, you know, it all starts with, first of all, arresting them and then down the road charging them. But let's talk about that. What are some of those things that people do that get people unjustly or excessively incarcerated?
Well, I would probably, first of all, maybe focus on myself as an example in particular.
Great, let's talk about that.
In my case, I went to prison because of tax charges. The issue in my case had nothing to do with taxes in the end. It had everything to do with jurisdiction. So I confronted my defense attorneys and I said, I'm not guilty of the charge alleged because of X, Y, and Z. They unequivocally looked at me and said, we will not argue your good faith belief because we believe it's frivolous and we can be charged according to the American Bar Association Code of Ethics. I knew something was wrong right then and there, because United States versus Cheek, which is a Supreme Court case back in 1992, said that a man could have a good faith belief no matter how unreasonable, and the jury should hear the good faith belief. So here I was, a man who was well read in the law, and I articulated to attorneys who were veterans in the system, denied a valid defense. Now, that's from a defense side. I could also look at my case and analyze what happened as far as the charges. And I'll give you a prime example. I wrote a series of letters over a matter of probably 8 years to anybody and everybody, from the Internal Revenue Agent all the way up to the IRS commissioner and even my senators and congressmen. Not once was my simple question ever answered by anybody. So there was an abject refusal of a good-hearted, genuinely convicted man in his belief to seek an answer, and he never got it. So we have been, therefore, a United States attorney who represented to the jury, in fact, that I had a liability to do X, Y, and Z, yet he knowingly knew that I sought in writing at least 12 to 15 times the answer to a question that would have allowed me to make a reasonable decision to do X, Y, and Z. So I take that as a personal example because I could then step back and look at someone like David Ingalls or Ryan Gosson or Tony Figueroa, which are men that I interviewed and then wrote about in this book. And I took their representations and I applied it to, for example, the prosecuting attorney, and I realized exactly how that compelled him or them to actually capitulate to a guilty verdict by leveraging them to a guilty verdict because of the pressure of, for example, a longer sentence.
Mm-hmm. So lengthy sentences are one of the many tools that DAs have at their discretion. Also multiple charges. That's another one. It seems like there's a tendency more and more to really stack charges and, doing non-concurrent sentences. So could you talk about some of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I one of the things that I found in the cross-section of cases and the men that I interviewed was, in fact, that they were facing anywhere from three times or four times as many years for arguing the case, for example, for going to trial, as opposed to simply capitulating and accepting a plea bargain. That's exactly what you spoke to. They also stack the charges, like you mentioned, or they threaten to go for a felony and then soft sell a misdemeanor in order to get them to capitulate. The irony is that 98 to 99% of people who are facing state and federal sentences actually accept a plea bargain because of the unjust pressure. And then you have the comparison of someone like me who actually knows and believes he's innocent and fights through a federal trial, and then I get a 2-point enhancement on my sentence and therefore increase in time because I didn't accept my responsibility because I decided to argue the case. So these are the little games they play. I know a man, for example, right now in prison who's got a 15-year sentence for bank fraud for a $4 million loan that never existed. This is with a bank out of Ohio. And he told his defense attorneys, he told the government, the loan doesn't exist. I don't have it with the bank. My company doesn't have it with the bank. And the U.S. attorney never took the time to go get the certified bank records to verify whether the loan exists or not. The FBI agent never did it. They actually looked at him and said, Mr. Carter, if you accept a plea of guilt right now, you will serve no prison time. He said, I'm not guilty. I will not do that. He went to trial, and he has 15 years. It's a crime, what mm-hmm. they did to him.
Yeah.
So it's cases like that, and I actually have him on my blog on the website. It's theendofjustice.com. His name was Orlando Carter, where it's very, very clear this man did not have an obligation to the bank, yet the government pursued him and applied the pressure to compel a sentence that is unwarranted.
In your book, you say that America is the most incarcerated country in the world. With only 5% of the global population, America has close to 25% of the prison population. And then you also said that you go and look back at as far back as 600 years to look at parallels of injustice. So let's take this way back first in your book, and let's talk about where did this come from? I mean, how did this whole system get started to where it's so crazy the way it is now?
We're dealing ultimately with the nature of man. And if we conclude, for example, at least for this discussion, let's say, that the nature of man is evil, that he does harm to himself and to other people, we can go back to cases like John Huss back in the 1400s or Galileo, 200 years later, or we can look at the Scottsboro boys, which are 9 black boys who were accused of raping 2 white women back in the 30s, which was really the impetus for the civil rights movement. And we can see how men do harm to other men. Very basic premise. So if we take a look at that and we springboard, for example, from the 30s to the 1980s, we realized that we went from a very small threshold of people in federal prisons in the 1980s to where we are today, which is over 200,000 people. So let me take this to the specific. We have an army of U.S. attorneys across this country that act on behalf of the President of the United States. And when they are given the charge of enforcing the law within their districts, they are accountable in essence to themselves and ultimately to the president. But I'm arguing that those above them do not get down close enough to the cases they're prosecuting to ascertain whether these United States attorneys are actually pursuing the truth, or in the alternative, like they did to Huss and Galileo and the Scottsboro boys, bringing harm to men and women who are being unjustly charged and therefore unjustly convicted. It's a very basic premise, and I think it really succinctly answers your question. Men doing harm to other men in the name of political gain because they want to become a congressman, they want to become a U.S. attorney or attorney general for a state or a governor for a state. They're looking out for their own good, and they don't pursue the truth.
Yeah, I mean, it's so, what you're saying is like so obvious. It's hard to believe that Americans don't see this, because when you look at rates of incarceration from, say, the 1970s and look at rates of incarceration now, you know, it's increased by like as much as 700%. And you just wonder, well, when did that happen? I mean, and I can tell you when it happened. It started in the 1980s. It started with the war on drugs. It started with Get Tough on Crime. It started with Three Strikes You're Out. It started with mandatory minimums. And who was pushing those? It was congressmen. It was congressmen. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, people running for office at the local level who were like, oh, we're going to get tough on crime and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And, you know, the overall levels of violence in communities didn't really change that much. The only thing that changed was that more people of color, more men were, more poor people were put in prison. And, you know, the only beneficiaries of that are Donald Trump and, you know, Mike Pence and all of his ilk. You know, it's like everyone who, you know, Rudy Giuliani, who apparently just got nominated to be the next Secretary of State. I mean, people who basically built their political fortunes on the backs of black men.
Yes. And the people that don't know any better, and I'll give you an example. And there's a video on theendofjustice.com where I speak to these statistics that talk about the fact that one in every three American adult who's on average the age of 23 has been arrested in this country. That should alarm all Americans. So the point being, and you underscore this aptly, is that in the video that's on the website, I state, and it's there to read, that a country is as free as the justice system is just. And my argument is that we cannot be a free country if we're the most incarcerated country in the world. So there's a point to be made here, and that is if we have an army of U.S. attorneys and prosecutors across the country who have no governor, i.e., there's no way to temper their authority, where they exceed the bounds of their authority, and they prosecute what they call it ultra virus, which is beyond their authority, which means beyond jurisdiction, by the way, then they are doing to their citizens what should not be done. And ipso facto, we become the most incarcerated country in the world. Sadly, I'll make this one final thought, is that most Americans, that goes to the second point of my thesis, are apathetic. We're ignorant and we're apathetic. We don't care unless it personally, directly affects us. So that's something I think we all need to embrace, the fact that we are not aware. And if we're aware, how much do we care or don't care to the point that the system continues to do what it's always done for the past 30 or 40 years?
So in your book, Bo, The End of Justice, which you can find at theendofjustice.com, you talk about the four corners of justice. I'm sorry. What are those four corners of justice? Can you don't even have to like tell me all the four corners, but just tell me what the idea is, basically.
Yeah, that's a great question. So if people are visual learners, for example, what I decided to do is, and by the way, I'll make this notation before I pull up the actual diagram. Anybody that wants a free MOBI file or ebook or PDF file of The End of Justice can enter the words "fear not" into the coupon box on theendofjustice.com, and they can download the book for free. And I really encourage people to actually get the book and look at the diagram itself, because the four corners of justice is a diagram that's shaped like a diamond. And so that's where the four corners are. If you look at the shape of a diamond in the diagram, I have broken the diagram into the just side, which is the right side of the diagram, and the unjust side, which is the left side of the diagram. So that representation right there is the four corners of justice. The 10 components are contained within the diamond, and there's a corresponding score for each component. So I'll give you an example. In my case, I would rate the defense attorneys at a -7, for example. And in other cases where the defense attorney did well, for example, in the Tony Figueroa case, I rated them perhaps 14 on the positive side, on the just side of the diagram. The point being is that right down the middle of the diamond, and people can see it when they download the book for free, there's a score of 0. Now, you and I would probably agree that a just system would run along the 0 line, as I call it, so that it would not fall to the left and to the unjust side, and it wouldn't have no need, but it could fall onto the just side or the right side where the scores are positive. I'm supportive of any scores on the positive side because people are fighting for justice. Any scores that go to the left of the 0 line is negative, and that's what we can't tolerate. We have to fight to bring the scores at least to the 0 line so they never go beyond into negative territory or the unjust side. That's the four corners of justice.
Thank you. So can we go, I'd like to talk to you just for a little bit about your own experience of incarceration, because part of what we talk about on Prison Pipeline is we talk about the prison industrial complex and things that we can do to change the process and to you know, make things better for people. And as someone who's experienced incarceration unjustly, your story is very compelling, and it's an important part of you know, the stories that we need to tell to bring a face to the language that we're using now. So can you just tell us how were you arrested, and what was your experience of incarceration?
I'm an average guy. I went to college. I went to a military school in Virginia, the Virginia Military Institute. I was a distinguished military graduate. I served my country in the Army. I was in the field of military intelligence. And then I got out and I decided to pursue my interests in the civil and the civilian life. So I'm a regular Joe. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a wife, I had children, I had a home, and I was fairly established and just a happy guy. I was arrested in a restaurant, and I had a SWAT team that came in as I was with my sister and my niece. And I had 15 federal agents who swarmed and came down on me with rifles drawn. I had laser dots all over my body, and I was arrested. It was a brutal experience. It was jarring, in fact. And I looked at what was going on, and I looked at my sister, who was in abject fear, and I realized that this was beyond the pale. But that was just the start of it, because I was then taken to two county jails. And after I was went to the initial hearing, I was thrown into solitary confinement with the murderers for 55 days. So here I was, an average middle-class guy who was now housed in a 7-by-10-foot cell with lights on 24 hours a day. I was shackled in order to be taken 20 feet to the shower, and then shackled in order to be taken back to my cell, housed with people who were serving 2 and 3 life terms for murder. And I said to myself, this can't be America. This is not real. It was so surreal that it defied my belief. And I actually had to take time and process what was going on. I sat there and I said, what's the end game? What are they trying to prove? What are they trying to accomplish? this was the beginning of my federal court experience. And from there, it in essence went downhill because the government was out to convict me and it didn't matter what happened.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. I really appreciate, when I work with prisoners, when I work with people who are formerly incarcerated, or even if they've been unjustly convicted, I try to avoid talking about the experience because I know it could be traumatizing. But I recognize that in your book, part of what you're trying to get out there is you're trying to get your story, because your own personal experience of having served, having had a distinguished career in the military and as an educated white professional, is a way of telling a story to people about incarceration that, really brings it home to a lot of people who might otherwise not be able to connect with those stories.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Well, we've got about maybe 3 or 4 minutes left, Bo, so let's get into your book for a couple of minutes. What inspired you to write the book? How did you decide to become motivated to do that after you were, released?
Well, I'm a very passionate person, and when I pursue something, I pursue it until I accomplish it. So with my unjust conviction and being taken away from my children for 3.5 years, I didn't see them for 3.5 years. I'm finally now able to have visits with them for 3 hours a week right now. I took a step back while I was in prison. And once I realized that the problem was as ubiquitous as it was with so many innocent people in prison, I knew I had to write a book. But I knew I had to write it in such a way that would convince the average Joe and Jane to suspend their disbelief and say, hey, I've got to give this a fair shake. I've got to realize, number one, I don't know the law. I accept the criminal, legal, and justice systems as grounded. And I'm too fearful. And this is the third key that applies to the American public. I'm too fearful to address it. So if your listeners will listen to me for a second, I want them to know that personally, I am not ignorant. I am not apathetic, and I am no longer fearful. I do not fear the federal government. And I think we ought to come to a point in our lives where we ameliorate the ignorance we have to the point that we're no longer apathetic and we can stand in our courage and say no more. We cannot and will not be the most incarcerated country in the world. And when my neighbor to the left and to the right is unjustly impugned by the justice system, I will stand with them. This is important because I've been on prison forums on the internet for the last week. And the cry of most people is we don't know what to do. And my appeal to them is to solve the level of ignorance and apathy they have about it. We have to become educated. So the long answer is, and I apologize for being long-winded, it's so important, is that I realized that there was a tremendous void with people's level of understanding about the system and the law. So we have to solve that. So I decided to write a book from a very personal perspective and get into the cases of men who were innocent. And I asked them, tell me how and tell me why. I'm going to convey it to the people in a way that they can understand it. And I think this book brings it home. That was my passion. That was my mission. And that is now The End of Justice, which is a book that people can get for free on theendofjustice.com. And I hope that answered your question, because it's a very important question.
Oh, it does, yeah. Mm-hmm. When you get into the cases of some men who have been convicted but are innocent. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say this, and because I think your point is well taken. I looked at their cases. And I looked at their body language, I looked at their word choice, I looked at their answers over a series of questions, and I believed them to be innocent. Now, I will tell you that I don't need to hear what the U.S. Attorney's argument is against him or against any number of them. The point being is that if a man in good faith can tell me why he's innocent and I can understand the representation and make the argument with the four corners of justice diagram that he is innocent, I don't need to hear the government's case. If I do hear the government's case, I can then square it and say, I know for certain that they're innocent. And I'll bring back Orlando Carter one more time. I have exhaustively researched his case. I know for a doubt that he has no $4 million loan with PNC Bank, and he never did. I do know that the U.S. attorney never went to the bank to get certified bank records to validate whether or not a $4 million loan existed. FBI agent Gormley never did that in Carter's case. I can hear Orlando's Carter's case, and I know the government never did their job, and they brought charges against him without warrant.
Well, thank you. So in our wrap-up, could you just again mention what is the name of your book and how can people find out about it? And if they would like to contact you personally, how can they reach you?
Absolutely. First of all, I'd like to thank you for your time. I thank you for the opportunity to share with your listeners. The book is The End of Justice, and it is an expose about how and why America is the most incarcerated country in the world, why we have the most imprisoned population. People can go to theendofjustice.com. If they want the book, there are two books, by the way. If they want The End of Justice, they can enter the words "Fear Not" into the coupon box at checkout, and they'll get the PDF file or the Mobi file or ebook file for free. If they want to get the book called The Ledge, they simply enter The Ledge, and they could get that for free as well. If people have inquiries or questions they want to ask of me, they can send an email to info@theendofjustice.com.
Great. Well, thank you so much for agreeing to be on Prison Pipeline, Bo. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and good luck with all of your efforts.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad.